is hiring and training a service advisor. This is where I think of kind of that next iteration. If you were in my first, in the first session with both myself and Kathy, we talked, spent one of the slides just talking about the evolutionary growth process of a traditional advisory firm, where the grassroots guerrilla part of it is you having, you working from doing everything yourself. And then you hire that first person who in the very beginning might act as a right-hand person, just handling some, dare I say, basic administrative stuff, with the goal of growing them into a large, like a larger full-time practice manager, you know, with larger roles and responsibilities. But eventually we have to shift our conversation if you're growing to scale yourself and find that even narrower lane of where you realize that your best and highest use of time in the firm is. Eventually you will realize potentially that your best and highest use of the time is not in a one-to-one, but a one-to-many capacity. And in order to have positive impact at scale, if that's what you're solving for, that you will eventually have to remove yourself from some or all of the one-to-one responsibilities that you have with clients. And that's what we're talking about here with hiring and training a service advisor, where you have the mindset and the vision. This is what we've branded in our firm. It's the vision. It's part of the fabric of the core values of the firm, that clients come because of me, but they stay because of us. So I am the promoter and positioner of our firm. I'm the personality that's out there in the optometry space, and fill in optometry with wherever your audience is, right? If that's retiree, retirees come because of me, they stay because of us. I am the one promoting and positioning myself in the retiree space, right? I say optometry, you say whatever your ICA, whatever your ideal client avatar is, and wherever you spend your time. So don't think that just because I'm saying optometry that, oh, well, that only applies to Adam, it doesn't apply to me. Wherever you are spending your time is the best and highest use of your time. And then it's a matter of how do you backfill yourself? How do you replicate yourself with the things that are going to be advantageous to you as it pertains to getting roles and responsibilities off your plate that you're not the best person to do anymore? I address it in a very self-deprecating way when we have a potential relationship reach out that we had one 2 weeks ago that I've listened to every hour of Adam's podcast from episode one, and I'm so excited to work with you. I appreciate that, right? Keyword, and that was you. I really appreciate that. You don't want to work with me. I will not give you that, right? So you can position this as you're not the best person for them because you have someone else whose sole responsibility and purpose is to take care and love on your clients and deliver the service and deliver the value and the experience that they asked for. You are not that special. None of us are that special. We are all replaceable. That was one of the things that took me a while to get comfortable with. And now I'm so glad that I have that mindset, that I'm not that special. One of the saddest and happiest days for me happened all in once, about three, no, that was a lot longer than that ago. I think it was about a year or so ago, when I essentially got fired from a client relationship in the meeting with John. Because they basically said, Adam, why are you here? I'm like, I just wanted to, they were one of the earlier clients that I've been working with. We had slowly been transitioning then to John. I still felt like I had to be there to, I was the relationship. They were working with me. And Adam, the client, ironically enough, was like, dude, John's been doing a great job. You don't need to be here. You can go do something else. And I'm like, wow, it worked, right? That was the success of it, that it worked to be able to transition those clients to John. But then the wow, it's like it worked. Not that special. I am replaceable. And you are all replaceable too, if that's what you're solving for. So what we're talking about here today is, again, how do we replicate yourself? And how do we hire someone that is going to be that best, that version of you that is what clients are asking for when they came to work with you, right? Clients, yes, they work with the name on the door much more than they work with the name above the door, right? If the on the door is the advisor, above the door is the firm name. But there is a way in which you position the firm as essentially those are synonymous. What's on the door is what's above the door. And the goal here is to make sure that we're hiring that best person. So we want to talk about getting your mindset right, hiring that rock star, and then training and communicate. Again, a lot of what we're going to be talking about here today is a variation in the theme of what we talked about in the rock star right hand. You're just solving for a different role on the bus. You're just solving for a different person. Yes, you are looking for that unicorn. Or as I interviewed someone for the podcast last week, and he's like, yes, sometimes we're looking for the pink unicorn. This is as it pertained to hiring an optician in an optometric practice. There's a very, very, very unique skill set when you find that absolute perfect optician, and he called it a pink unicorn. So yes, we are all wanting to hire that unicorn. And the nice thing is that they are out there. One of my favorite phrases from a hiring standpoint is that the best person that you would want on your team is already a rock star on someone else's team. And so the best place to start looking for people is to go and position yourself, position the firm so that other people that are already employed can find those people. So that's where, again, I'm not going to state anything that you probably haven't already heard before, but that's where it's a full court press in reaching out to everybody that you know in the business that might know of someone, wholesalers, internal and external, your tech partners, recruiters, if you decide to go down that route. There's a time and place for those individuals as well. Your soft, I think I mentioned this, your software providers, trainers that you have, anybody and everybody that might know another advisor is a great place to go start fishing. You lever your social media platforms, reach out to people on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, wherever you're spending your time. Again, and use an attractive job description. I'm getting ahead of myself here a little bit, but we'll talk about that process. So, right, the first thing that we want to do is we want to define the role requirements and so on and so forth through the hiring process. The first step there is obviously one of the most important parts. And just as I mentioned in the very beginning of the, or in the Rockstar Right-Hand presentation, this is arguably the easiest part of the entire process because all you have to do is take inventory of the tasks and the responsibilities and what you do on a day-to-day basis that is on the advice side of things and think of how can I remove this from my day-to-day operation. So the easy low-hanging fruit for a service advisor, and again, part of this is understanding and defining how we want to, how do we define a service advisor? Is this a service advisor? I will tell you, there is a difference in our firm between a lead advisor and a service advisor. The lead advisor is the one dispensing and giving advice, period, full stop. It's who the client sees as their advisor. It's who the client is taking the direct advice from. A service advisor, a client service advisor, is essentially that second chair person. They are the ones that are going to be implementing and helping the client on the follow through and on the actions that are being recommended by the lead advisor. And that service advisor is also doing the case prep. They're doing the plan data analysis. They're running tax projections in HolistiPlan. John uses a great metaphor during the interview process when we were interviewing candidates for our CSA, for our client service advisor position. John's like, I want you to think of we're walking through a jungle and you're the person with the machete in the front. You're just chopping things down, clearing the way for us to do work together. You're the one that's doing the bare bones data entry into the financial plan, building the financial plan scenarios in eMoney, running the tax projections in HolistiPlan, looking and entering the data from the profit loss balance sheet, statement of cash flow, again, unique to our clients, but they're the ones putting that data into the spreadsheets that we've created so that John essentially has this path cleared where he can now see the data from a 30,000 foot view, see the path forward and tweak it. In the process of him tweaking that, he is also coaching her. He's also teaching her the process from a planning perspective. The person that we hired as a CSA to complement John, to sit second chair to John, she has passed the CFP board exam, but she will have the 3 years experience requirement in November of this year, I believe. So her goal, her aspirational goal is to eventually, sit second chair, or excuse me, sit on second, on, sit as a lead advisor, sit in John's role. And we have a whole career track to get her to be there at the rate in which we're bringing on clients. We told her you will likely be there in 18 to 36 months. So we have that career trajectory for her as well. So I want to give that overarching theme, or not theme, kind of set expectations and define how we think of client service advisor in our firm. You're free to reconcile that and use that or reconcile that against what you're hiring for. But I want to make sure that as I'm talking through this process, when I think of service advisor, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm solving for. Lead advisor is basically doing all of those things and dispensing the advice. What we're realizing though, and what we've gotten to is we've reached a capacity issue with John. There's just not enough hours in a day for him to be able to do all the things that a service advisor is doing and create all the plans and handle all the meetings with the clients. There's just not enough time. So the goal here is to remove that back end service, the the tax return analysis, the data entry, the follow through with the client, helping them get their estate plan in place by working with the attorney, getting an umbrella policy in place by working with their PNC agent, restructuring life insurance policies with their existing, like all of that advice related financial planning knowledge required tasks are now off of John and going to be with Kate. John, meanwhile, is going to be the one that's going to be able to show even more love to our existing clients, thus generating more referrals, more quality introductions, et cetera. So take a deep breath. And that's, I wanted to kind of set expectations about, around what we solved for in our firm. And I'll put everything that I'm talking about here going forward in this share through that filter. That's how I'm thinking about the slides as we go forward. So with that being said, back to regularly scheduled programming here, define role and requirements. I just did that. Then we want to source, screen, shortlist, deep screening, and then make the offer. This is, Paul, I see you in this session as well. This is, I think you're in this session. This is the process that we used. Write the epic ad. I will post a link. If you weren't in the previous session, I will share it here as well in chat. This is the job posting that we created for the client service advisor that we just hired. We have two phenomenal candidates. Sidebar, if any of you are looking for this type of role, I do have a very, very good candidate. We had someone down in Texas. She's in Lubbock, and we don't believe that we could have gone wrong with either one. It was literally almost getting a coin and deciding which one we were going to make the offer to. So I do have another candidate, a rockstar candidate that we have taken through this entire process and then some, candidly, that I would be happy to introduce. So if anybody is looking to hire a CSA for their firm, let me know in chat, reach out to me on Tribe, ping me somehow and let me know, and I'd be happy to make an introduction to this candidate. But as you can see here, this is the entire process that we go through. Everybody is involved in this process. I met with the person first, then Kathy met with them. And then as we got through the process, essentially starting on step six, this is when we brought John into the conversation. So John, obviously working very closely in tandem with this individual, we certainly wanted to have him have a voice in this conversation because he's the one that's going to be working with her for the majority of the time once we're through the onboarding process. I'm shifting obviously much more into a leadership and executive role within the firm, not as much involved in the day-to-day operations of client service. So a lot of that is going to fall onto John directly. So John got involved on step six and seven, eight, nine, et cetera. So that's the process that we went through. Again, good hiring, bad hiring. I think of this as Captain Obvious, but it's not, because we've seen and had advisors that have not done it right. First, make sure that you're having a disciplined approach. Make sure that you are being methodical and calculated and intentional about your process. Please don't just shoot from the hip and make hiring decisions quickly. They are hire slow and fire quick. So it is not uncommon. I mean, we started hiring for this position. I believe we made the posting in March. I'd have to go back and look. It might have even been earlier than that. Candidly, we didn't get as many hits as what we thought in the very beginning. So this process has taken even longer than we wanted it to. But there's no substitute for just being thorough in that process. Make sure that you're letting your personality show from a firm standpoint in the job description. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. So make sure that you are writing that job description in a way that's going to be attractive for someone reading it that you would like to attract. Let your personality come out in that job description, because it's going to be the first time that they interact with your firm in a written way. Yes, they're also going to Google you. They're also going to go to your website. So it would be nice if both of those had a concurrent and common theme, that the language was very similar, that the atmosphere, not the atmosphere, but the personality of your website and the personality of your job description were as synonymous as possible. Because again, this is their first impression, and like attracts like. So if you write a very cold, dry, unemotional, left brain type job description, but you are not that person, there's a disconnect between what you're posting versus who you actually are. So make sure that you do everything that you can to write the job description and the job posting in a way that is going to be attractive and that there's a synergy, if you will, with the person reading it versus who you are and who you're looking to hire. The compensation package, there's always a debate about this and about how you pay someone. There's various different studies out there in which you can benchmark off of, whether it's Schwab, TD, Dimensional Funds also produces some of those reports. I'm sure there's other fund companies that do their own internal research. Investment News publishes theirs. I think ThinkAdvisor does some type of study as well. I want to be careful with the word study because I don't know how they're actually gathering that data. It's largely, or it's likely just submission. So maybe in place of study, it's just opinion fact gathering. I don't want to be too granular there in the definitions, but there's a lot of different ways. I think the common theme here as it pertains to compensation is you will be rewarded for paying up. If you are penny wise and pound foolish and you hire bottom of the barrel, dare I say, there's no exception to getting to the phrase, you get what you pay for in life. And this is certainly not that exception. So be very comfortable in paying for talent, because even though they show up as an expense on your profit loss, you should absolutely be getting a return on investment for that individual. If you don't know what that return on investment is going to be, do not PESCO, do not collect $200, go back to your business plan and figure out what the trajectory is going to be for your firm post-hire. Because again, the role, the ideal situation when you're hiring someone, assuming that you're doing this to free up your time, you now have to ask yourself, well, what is the opportunity cost, or I should say, what is the opportunity benefit now that I get from having to release myself of these responsibilities? And sometimes that just might mean more free time. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what you are solving for, and you're saying, you know what, hiring this person means I'm going to take a pay cut because I don't really plan on driving any more revenue. So my net income is going to take a hit. But you know what? I don't need any more money. I need more time. I just want more quality, peace of life. If that's what you're solving for, great. I'm just saying, be clear on what you are solving for, whether it's time and or money, and understand how that person is going to get you there. If you're solving for money, right? Well, then understand, of course, there's going to be a hit to the profit loss statement. There's going to be a hit to your cash flow statement in the very beginning, because you're going to have another mouth to pay, right? You're going to have another bank account to feed by having someone on payroll. And there's going to be a decent amount of upfront transient costs in getting that person on board, whether it be a new computer, new home office setup, or whatever it is that you're going to do, right? Those one-time transient expenses. And then you're also going to have the ongoing expenses, not just in payroll expense, my friends, but you're also going to have the additional seats for your password management, for your scheduling software, for your CRM, for your performance report, right? All of those different users, 20 bucks here, 50 bucks there, 75 bucks a month, right? All of that adds up. So yes, do the cost analysis breakdown to figure out what it's going to cost you to hire this person. But then with that person, understand what is your capacity going to be now that you have another warm body in the bus? What capacity, how many more relationships can you serve? And when does that break even? When essentially do you catch up to the profitability? Because all you're doing right now is sinking today's profits into a future benefit in the firm. So you certainly want to make sure that you're getting a return on that investment, again, both in time and money. So digression there as we're talking about pay and accountability there. Design your own staffing strategy. Again, different ways you can think about this, both in-person, hybrid, or completely remote, as well as part-time or full-time. Again, just for what it's worth, our path has been, I originally had thought of going like serving our clients nationally. Right now we have clients in, I think it's 38 states, 35, something like that, mid-30s. And I had originally thought that I was going to have all of our team centrally located here in Carmel, Indiana, north side of Indianapolis. And that has certainly changed. John is down in Texas. As I mentioned, Kate, who's joining us, is in Virginia Beach. So we are running a virtual practice and her clients have known none the wiser. So it's no big deal. And we are actually in the process of shutting down our physical office space because, again, going back to that cost benefit analysis, and I look at the expenses of my business and where is a good return on that investment, spending $2,400 bucks a month on office space just isn't the best use of that capital right now. There's other places that I'd like to deploy that into the business and personally that. So again, you have options as you look to do that. That was one of the biggest differences that I appreciated about thinking about what it would mean to make my business virtual and attract talent nationwide. It's made it a lot easier to find the ideal candidate because I'm not constrained by the geographical ring of finding someone within a, let's call it, 30-minute radius of Carmel, Indiana. It poses its own set of challenges in making sure that my business is set up to be virtual, where we have all of our all of the things that we know, right? All of our systems, all of our processes, to have all of that institutionalized and captured. By the way, it's not that hard. It's just, it takes a little bit of time and intention. We have everything in Redtail, ShareFile, and Loom, and Asana. So four platforms, right? ShareFile, Loom, Asana, and Redtail. ShareFile, Loom, Asana, Redtail. Yeah, those four platforms is essentially where our entire business lives. So there, it does create its own set of challenges to be able to transition your business into a virtual setting. But again, the benefit of that is that it opens up the talent pool nationwide. Talked about this already from a job description standpoint. Again, just be very specific. Create that candidate avatar of what you're looking to be, of who you're looking to hire. Make sure that you have the qualifications, the profile, the skills required. Go back to that big, or that high level view slide later on in that process. You should be testing for that. What we did in our hiring process is we did two redacted case studies of our existing clients. So I had that. I think I did. I actually did them. I and Kathy did them. We went through every piece of data that a client had provided to us after being with or after going through the initial intake process. So it was back when we were doing one page plans. We gathered six key pieces of documentation, as well as anything else that the client sent to us that they had questions about. So we went through all the data and we redacted everything to protect PII. And we sent that to the client or to the candidate. And we said, and John did this as well as the candidates that we hired. John did this when I was hiring for the lead advisor role. And we did this as well for Kate when we're hiring for the CSA. And we told her, we told them, the candidates, John and this candidate pool, to build a financial plan. Tell us the recommendations, what you observed, what are the gaps, what are the pieces, the additional pieces of data. In fact, I can share, let me see if I can do this on the fly real quick. I can share the text expander language that we used, that we sent out when we did that. So let me see if I can do that real quick. Of course, text expander is asking for an update in the middle of this process. Because again, I think it's important to be clear about install and relaunch. Sure. And I think everybody's able to see my text expander there, which is no big deal. But if anything, it just gives you a peek behind the curtain as to how in-depth our text expander is and how much we use it. So email templates. Let's see if I can search this. Hiring. Can't remember what we saved it under. Well, I'll see if I can find it. I don't want to derail conversation here too much. Advisor request, interview, case studies. Here we go. So I'll paste in chat. You can copy and paste as you see fit. And then what we did in that email is we put the links to the case studies that we used in sending that. How we did that is we asked them to be in front of their computer at a specific time when we could send them the case study and had them have a block of time available. We said that there was not a time limit. And again, I think I go through this. Kathy, I think, added to this in the sense that we didn't set an expectation of like, hey, you need to get this to us within an hour. But we did say, submit back to us your one page plan when you're done. The reason we did that is we didn't want them to be able to send this off to, you know, their best friend who's a lead CFP for some high net worth planning firm that was able to do the case for them. So we wanted to have do what we could to have a dedicated and insulated from shenanigans. We wanted to do it in a way that we were testing them and them alone. So let us know when you're going to be in front of your computer so that we can send you this email. You'll get the case study links in that email. Click on the links, download the data, put together one page plan, and send it over to us when you're done. It's not a timed event, but we wanted to see how long it took them to put these summaries together. I think we received both of them back within about an hour and a half of each other, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. But again, it's one of the ways in which we're able to test for the skills required, as you can see at the bottom there, which is obviously, as we're talking about the advice side of this responsibility or this role, is very important. compensation plan. Again, I think the thing that I would add on top of this is don't underestimate the importance of non-cash compensation, right? Whether that's, and arguably this is cash versus, you can think of this as cash, non-cash. I included a 2000, I mean, John and Kate get a 2000 or get a, each of them is a little bit different, but they get a PD budget, a personal development budget as part of their compensation. They don't just get it paid out. They have to submit essentially for either expense reimbursement or a pre-approved trip. Hey, Adam, I want to go to AICPA in Vegas this year to get some CEN tax planning. Awesome. That can fall under your PD budget. Adam, I want to go to the Napa conference because John's very involved in Napa. Awesome. That's part of the PD budget. It's not, and it is a use it or lose it type thing. So it's not something that, oh, Adam, I didn't use my PD budget. Can I just get this paid out? No, that's not how that works. So work location, flex hours, cash, bonuses, culture, like all of those things, don't underestimate the importance of those and communicate those in the job description. Again, you'll see it in my job description posted on the link that I said or that I pasted in chat. And it's also built into the offer letter as well. So I'm putting literally my money where our posting was, money where the mouth is, right? Talked about this, make sure that your personality, make sure that it grabs their attention. Lots of different ways in which you can source those candidates through referrals, COI networks, your clients. Be careful with the client. One of the phrases that we use, don't ever hire someone you couldn't fire. So be careful when you're hiring clients, spouses, friends of clients, family members, other friends of yours, right? Just keep that in mind. Never hire someone that you couldn't fire. And if you are going to have that conversation or you are going to hire someone that does have a personal relationship where there's essentially baggage that comes with them, just baggage in the form of a previous relationship or previous filter in which you know them, just be very clear in setting that expectation up front. One of my favorite phrases that's applicable in every aspect of life, there is a seamless transition when communication ends to resentment setting in. And so be sure to be transparent with this person up front to say, as best you can, we're going to put a line up, a wall up here on our relationship. And we both have to be comfortable that if things don't work out for either one of us, that, you know, just talk it through. I don't have any suggestions on how to do that because I've never made that decision. I stay 100% clear of that. I don't want that to influence my decisions. I don't want a previous part of the relationship to influence my decision. The interview process, again, be very transparent and be very thorough in that. Don't hire just based off the feels. Don't hire based off of just how good they are on Zoom or on an in-person meeting. Just remember, the person that you're getting on Zoom, they're there for a job interview. So they are going to be the absolute best version of themselves in that interview. It can only go downhill from there is the cynical way of on how I think about it. So the best person that they are is the person that you get in the interview. So it's important to, that's again, why you're thorough in this process, because you want to get multiple different angles of that person, different times of the day, different times of the week in which you're interviewing them to see how they are on Monday versus how they are on Thursday. Are they a morning person? Are they an afternoon? Like, try and introduce those things through the interview process so that you try and get as well-rounded of an understanding as of that person as possible. The screening, I love the DISC, Colby, and StrengthsFinder. The StrengthsFinder is Clifton Strengths. If you just Google Clifton Strengths, all one word, that will take you to the StrengthsFinder. The skills testing, mentioned this already, looking at can they demonstrate competence with different pieces of technology. If they put something on their resume where they have experience, you know, have experience in Salesforce, great. Ask them about a project that they worked on in Salesforce or whatever it might be that you can test for, right? Test that knowledge, make sure that they can actually deliver on what they have on the resume. So reconcile and think about ways in which you can take your testing process, your skills testing process through what they have shared on their resume. I learned, again, I shared this in the previous session. I learned that I versus an assistant that I had hired years ago, we had very different definitions of what processing paperwork meant. I thought that processing paperwork meant filling out the paperwork through DocuSign, sending it off to the client, getting it signed, uploading to the custodian, managing money movement, et cetera. All things that we, I think, would assume are housed under the definition of processing paperwork. Her definition of processing paperwork was taking the data that a client would drop off as part of their financial plan and scanning it. That's it. No processing, just scanning. Oh, there's their estate plan. This goes into their estate planning folder. Here's an account statement. This goes into their investment folder. That was her definition of processing paperwork. So make sure that you're testing or that your process from a testing standpoint actually draws out their experience based off of what they have shared on their resume. The training process, I cannot emphasize importantly or enough. The worst thing that you can do is to spend an incredible amount of time, talent, and energy through the interview process, hire a great person, and then make the assumption that because they're a great person, you can just say, all right, here's a desk, a phone, and your computer. Godspeed and good luck. Right? You're a great advisor. You should know what to do, right? Please don't make that that mistake. They should be essentially your shadow for the first, specifically a generic definition here, for the foreseeable future, right? Everybody's going to be different based off what you're hiring for. For John, when he came on board, essentially as that CSA / lead advisor, like he was lead advisor material, but in the beginning, it was just CSA type responsibilities just to get him involved in client service. He was in every single meeting I had with a client for probably the first 3 months. So he was shadowing me in every single client meeting because it was a way for me to introduce him to clients that he was eventually going to take over. And it got him comfortable with the clients and it allowed me to share with him how we did things, how we followed up with clients, how we use how we use the different platforms after meeting with a client. I would have him, as he penned email responses to clients for the first couple of weeks, I would want to review those drafts before they got emailed out, just to make sure that the language, I wasn't testing for the competency, because John teaches a CFP course at Texas A&M. So I didn't really have a question or didn't have an issue with any of his competence. It was more so just the language that he was using in the communication. Was that on brand with what we were positioning? And it didn't take too long for me to say, yeah, I don't need to do that anymore. Trust, but verify, right? That's kind of the whole premise behind this training approach. Yes, it is going to take your time in the beginning. And yes, it might feel counterintuitive to what you think that you're doing because you hired this person to free up your time. And while yes, that is true for the long term, that doesn't relieve you of the responsibility of making sure that you onboard them in a way that is going to allow them to seamlessly take the baton of responsibilities from your plate to their plate. When there's a misalignment of expectations, that's where you can have the friction occur between the relationship. And the worst thing about that, when that happens, is that potentially a client relationship is the one that gets compromised and where the client experience gets jeopardized. So make sure that you're taking those time for the consistent check-ins. John and I would have daily check-ins. I don't recall exactly how long we did that, but I would say, it was at least the first month where we were checking in on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times per day, morning and afternoon. We do not do the proverbial, again, we can't do this directly because John's not in person. The virtual version of this that we have is we do have a Slack channel, a firm Slack channel. Be careful with a firm Slack channel because that can very quickly turn into the proverbial, knocking at the office door, or poking her head around the corner and interrupting, or if not worse, saying the dreaded inner office reply all email, just filling up your inbox with yet another useless email. Urgent doesn't always mean important. Or excuse me, important doesn't always mean urgent. So make sure that you're teaching them and setting expectations with them that not everything that you get is both urgent and important. Ask them to triage that appropriately and make that decision, and then bunch up those times where you can get together and give them that feedback again during your daily, sometimes multiple times per day check-ins. Eventually, that will start to subside where now John and I only get together once a week. It's on Mondays after our team-wide meeting that we do for an hour. John and I get together for about an hour, sometimes it's a little bit less. And we use it as planners club. Essentially, if he's working through a client case, if he's working through something with one of our relationships that he wants my perspective, usually it's from the business side of things with clients buying a practice, selling a practice, we're doing valuation, whatever it might be. It's usually on the business side of optometry that I'm getting involved in that. But even that has been, has gone down as he has gotten more and more involved with that. Side note to this, I will say another very underappreciated at the time, and I didn't know how beneficial it would be, but it's turning out to pay a lot of dividends. My podcast, 2020 Money, is essentially serving as a training platform for John. That was one of the ways in which John was able to get up to speed more on the business side of optometry and the language of optometry. And so we've gone through the podcast and created a greatest hits playlist, essentially, that Kate will listen to as part of her training and onboarding process to get her to understand the ins and outs, the ABCs and 1-2-3s of optometry. She's not going to be an expert in the very beginning, but it will be part of her task board in Asana through her onboarding process to listen to these episodes. And then we'll have discussions and digressions about those podcasts, about those topics. Again, because if she wants to grow into the point of a lead advisor, that will be required knowledge for her to have. So again, talk openly, often, et cetera. This is something that I'm absolutely passionate about thinking about encouraging advisors to think about. There's a difference between a leader and a manager. A leader, you manage systems, you lead individuals, you lead teams. So managing people, in my opinion, is just a professional definition for babysitting. I don't want to babysit. I don't want to micromanage. I want to empower you to think on your own and make the executive decision. Two standing rules apply. If you're thinking about making a decision, number one, is it in the best interest of the client? Is it going to provide a great client experience or give the client what they're asking for as to why they chose to work with our firm? If the answer to that is yes, is it in the best interest of the firm? If you can answer yes to both of those questions and it's below the spending threshold that I've given you, I don't want to hear about it. Godspeed, you're here to do a job. Do the job and lead the client, serve the relationship. I don't want to be involved in those decisions. That's not the best and highest use of my time. Micromanaging kills productivity. It kills efficiency. It kills morale. It destroys trust. If you embrace it from a leading mentality and you hire the right person to do the job, make sure they know what the goal is and then just get out of the way and let them solve the problem. Give them that permission though. Don't assume that they know that you will do that. You have to be explicitly clear that they have that authority. Two standing rules in our firm: the trust bank is always full on day one. It's up to them to spend down that currency. And number two, you have as much authority as you take in this business until someone has told you you've taken too much, which feeds into the first part that I talked about. If you're thinking about doing something new or you want to do something for a client or you wanted whatever that might be, is it in the best interest of the client? And is it in the best interest of the firm? If one and two are true, then by all means do it. And then fill us in. Like, I'm just not saying go blindly and do things. Like, we want to know what you're doing, but that's something that you don't need to ask for permission about something like that. We'll talk about it at either the annual strategic planning meeting. Usually it's something that gets brought up before that. That would be typically something that we talk about during our 3M meeting, Monday morning meeting, which is a variation on Gina Wickman's level 10 meeting. If any of you have ever read Traction or understand EOS, the Monday morning meeting for us is essentially our level 10 meeting. So that's where John or Kathy or I or now Kate will bring ideas, changes, new things that they've thought of or that they'd like to do or whatever that is. That's when we will have that discussion. Very structured, very timely. We're prepared for it. It's not the, again, you know, knock at the door, poking their head around, interrupting my flow, them interrupting their flow. It's just, you've got to have that cohesiveness and that system in place. Talked about the training plan already, right? The introduction, weekly check-ins, monthly, quarterly. You do have to have reviews with people. And that's one of the harder things for managers to get over as well, or not get over, but become accustomed with, is that we can become so tunnel vision and just grinding and grinding and grinding as entrepreneurs, as business owners. We've never had someone do a performance review for us. I've had 9 months of my professional life where someone other than me has issued my paycheck. So I'm not used to getting performance reviews. I've never known what those are. So, but team members, employees do ask for those and do want to know. And it's your responsibility and it's your opportunity to level set with them, share your expectations, where they're exceeding, where they're maybe not exceeding, own to the extent that you can why they might be under succeeding, ask them what they need to be successful in that role based off the expectation that you've set, and then collaboratively determine what the process is going to be for them to accomplish this. Use that as an opportunity to not place fault, but rather empower them to solve the problem on their own and then be there to support them. One of the core values that I have in the firm that John knows, that Kathy knows, that Kate knows, is that I promise that they will be as successful as they want to be in this profession to the extent that they aspire to achieve that success. Fancy way of saying, I'm not just going to give you pay raises and promotions and things like that. Like, you have to want them, but I will allow you to be like, I want them to be as successful as they want to be in their career within this organization. So long as those two rules that I talked about can be met, is it in the best interest of the client? And is it in the best interest of the firm? if it is, I will make a way to, I will find a way to make that happen, because that person that's doing that is someone that I absolutely want to have on my team for the long haul. I don't find that out unless I'm having quarterly check-ins, unless I'm having annual conversations with individuals to find out, how can I help support you in your career? What am I not providing that you want to have access to? What do you want to learn more about? Oh, I'd really love to get more into tax planning. Great, let's talk about that. I'd really like to talk a little bit more about exit planning. Awesome, let's figure out how we can implement that into our service model and into your educational curriculum so that you can be that subject matter expert for our clients. Right? What's the classic snarky phrase? Want better answers, ask better questions, and create the space in that plan, create the space in your calendar to have those conversations. Again, talked about all this already, making sure that you're setting standards, communicate. Again, lots of different resources that we have on the within Limitless Library, both as it pertains to the hiring process, hiring documents, as well as a training process. I have admittedly not looked at Q&A or chat much, so I'm going to take a breath here. I'm also going to take a swig of water because my throat's getting a little raw and do a quick lay of the landscape here. Again, as a reminder, if you have Q&A, use... never mind. I don't want to make that announcement. We've got a lot of questions already in the Q&A, so I'll spend some time going through that. So, all right. Let me scroll through chat here. I don't think there's... Okay. How is your CSA different than a paraplanner? This goes back to the ambiguousness of the definitions. In our role, the paraplanner is one of the responsibilities essentially built into that CSA. Part of her responsibility, if you look at our job description, and I can paste that again in chat just in case you didn't grab it or were a little bit late. Our fifth, like right in the middle of the responsibilities, the fifth bullet point down, two, three, four, yeah. Formulate financial planning strategies for clients, perform case prep and communicate actionable items. Like that's all paraplanner type responsibilities. So a paraplanner role is nested within this CSA role. What's the best way you found to test a potential candidate for whether or not they are detail oriented detail-oriented, one of the best ways that I like to do that was actually on a form. It's what I used to hire Kathy, is I would have like three different account forms, and then I would transpose a social security number, or I would change a date of birth. Instead of 830-69, I would have 830-79 on, 830-69 on one form and 830-79 on another form. Or I would, fat finger a key, something like that, and test to see whether they got, whether they saw those. Spelling of last names is another area. Another way from a detail oriented is, as weird as it sounds, this is somewhat related to that. I am old school in the sense that I like handwritten notes. So if they haven't sent a handwritten thank you card or they haven't done anything, I'll ask for a writing sample. Just because, can you do something without spell check? Can you, what does your handwriting look like? If you're going to be sending notes to clients, thank you cards, call me old school, but I think that stuff does matter. And so, and it also just, again, tests for a different level of competence in that sense. So detail-oriented, the one way that we would check in the very beginning is the job description. So if you look at our job description, at the very bottom, it says, interested candidates should send a cover letter and resume as a PDF. If we receive a resume as a Word document, delete it. Do not, like, you couldn't follow very basic descriptions, very basic instructions in the job description. Again, going back to what I'd said, the person that they're interviewing, if they're interviewing for this position, is assumed to be giving you the best version of themselves. And so if they missed it there, where else are they going to miss it? So, and the other part, 50% of a resume is bullshit, but that's a different conversation for a different day. So that's where that's another place. Can you follow those simple instructions on how to apply? If they emailed our firm, we specifically told you in red text, do not try and contact us through any other method. So that's another way that we would test for test for detail orientation. With a virtual position and now firm, do you meet candidates face to face, or do you feel Zoom is good enough? From a candidate standpoint, Zoom is good enough. I will say that I did this with John, and we're doing this with Kate. Kate is landing in the next 30 minutes in Indianapolis, and she'll be spending the week starting tomorrow morning. She'll be spending the week in our office. And then John is coming up from Texas. He's flying up Wednesday night. He'll be here Thursday and Friday, and then John and Kate will be leaving Friday afternoon. So we'll spend time in the very beginning onboarding. Kathy, I won't be spending any time with her tomorrow and Wednesday. Kathy will be spending time, and then John, I, Kathy, and Kate will be spending, well, I shouldn't say any time, but I'll say hi, obviously, and a little bit of small talk in the very beginning. But the majority of the time that she's going to spend tomorrow is going to be with Kathy, just going through the operations, lay of the land on the computer, file structure, getting her logged in. We've got it all set up already, but just kind of getting her through that process. For a solo firm, what position would you recommend the first hire be? Admin, ops, CSA, service advisor? John, I would say it would depend on what you're solving for. What's the biggest time suck? I would go back to that inventory. Where are you spending the most time? My guess is most advisors, it's on the admin side of things, paperwork, client service. Kathy touches a lot of client service stuff. Where we draw the line is on the advice side of things. So if this requires giving the client advice, that is now on the CSA side of things. If it is still ops related, like sending money out, pulling money in, doing Roth conversions, like the act of Roth conversion, the act of converting the Roth, sending the paperwork in, talking to the custodian, et cetera. All of that is on Kathy's plate. That's not on John. John can do it. It's not the best and highest use of John's time. So most firms struggle from a time standpoint on the administrative back office side of things, and then can up level into the paraplanner CSA role. How do you suggest team members track time working on each client, Toggle or other tool? This is admittedly something that we haven't spent a whole lot of time experimenting with, other than just like analog version, just trying to document that time and looking at the number of hours that we spend. We do use Acuity to pull a report for each client as to how many appointments they have had in the course of working with us. So have they had, you know, how many different client phone calls have they had? How many different emails have been sent out through Redtail? So we can pull that data to try and guesstimate how much in hourly service per year our firm is providing to clients. I wish there was a much more robust and seamless way to track that. Toggle, I've heard things about Toggle. I haven't done due diligence to give it any type of personal feedback, but yeah, that is a potential option to look at quantifying the amount of time that you're spending. Sorry, Sarah, I don't have a whole lot of other suggestions outside of, yeah, you got to track it somehow. So we essentially duct tape it together a little bit more than maybe we should. It's on the list, right? Do you serve as chief compliance officer, or do you outsource? If so, what does outsourcing look like? Good question, Kevin. So legally, yes, I sign as a CCO. I haven't outsourced that true legal responsibility. I do have a compliance consultant that I'm using. I'm in the process of interviewing and transitioning that to Beach Street Legal, just because and maybe this is where you're going with it, it's not the best and highest use of my time. It's a little bit more of a time suck, especially as we look at, I'm in that in-between stage right now of, I think we're having to register because we're getting to that 5 client de minimis in like half a dozen states. So my compliance is turning into a freaking nightmare. I am praying that at our continued trajectory that we will be on the pace to be SEC registered. Although I've had some advisors say you don't want to be SEC registered, but I'm getting sick of having to track multiple different state requirements. I'd like to be in the SEC purview and be able to have just one big brother to answer to instead of, I don't even know how many states we're registered in right now. So yes, CCO outsourcing can and is a little bit of a time suck, and it's something that I'm working to outsource even more than what I am right now. Do you have a way to test for tech skills with a candidate? Briefly mentioned this, Kevin, but like this is an example. Look at what they had listed on their resume. If they have experience with Salesforce, ask them to walk you through a project that they did. If they did something with us with a technology that you know, great. Have them run through a case study with you. Pull up eMoney, pull up the sample client. Every eMoney platform has a sample client in it. Have them run through Decision Center with you and have them build a couple of scenarios in the Decision Center. Hey, can you create some what-if scenarios of What if they sell the business and decide to delay Social Security timing and then reduce their retirement income expenses by $10,000, but also build in a travel budget for $15,000 a year for the first 10 years of retirement? Like, if they have experience with e-money, like, that should be that's a layup type process. So test for things that you know in live time. I had zero issues asking Kate to do something like that. And she delivered. So yeah, that's one way in which you can test for tech. It depends on what it is that you're solving for, what type of tech that you are trying to test. Hopefully that answers your question, Kevin. Any follow-up to that? Let me see if I missed any questions here. What are some examples of salary bonus percentage total comp for CSA and lead advisor, 80% salary? So our position that we hired for is basically, it is salary and then 5% discretionary bonus with eligibility for profit sharing if I decide to make that discretionary contribution or discretionary profit sharing into the 401k, as well as some of the above the line comp. Like I said, personal, a PD budget, health insurance, matching 401k, et cetera. For John in a service or in a lead relationship role, John's is much easier. It's 30% of revenue served. John gets a flat salary. And then the bonus essentially is the delta between 30% of revenue served and $100,000. So if 30% of revenue served is $200,000, then John's quarterly bonus, again, the math, just illustrating the point here, then John's quarterly bonus is $25,000, right? $200,000, 30% of revenue served is $200,000. His base is $100,000. So we've got $100,000 of bonus paid four times per year, $25,000 per quarter. And that's where running an AUM business, running our fee structure, both through Advice Pay and through Orion on the fee billing or on the AUM side of things, both platforms allow the pulling of that data in a pretty easy way. It doesn't take too much for me to calculate what John's bonus is going to be.